listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In this week's conversation with Joe Loria, the executive editor of ConsortiumNews.com, we take a look at Russiagate a year after evidence demonstrated that it was a leak and not a hack. Newly released declassified documents prove once and for all that CIA Director Gina Haspel did in fact oversee torture in Thailand and that the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee knew it all along. Also, a USS Liberty survivor who was arrested by Israel this month trying to break the blockade of Gaza, spoke with Consortium News Radio. So, Joe, we're going to take a look at the front page at ConsortiumNews.com.
Don, thank you for having me on to talk about the front page of Consortium News.
Yes,
I just posted today a really interesting interview I did, a radio interview. This is Consortium News Radio, which I launched like 6 days ago. My first interview was with Peter Van Buren, the whistleblower from the State Department, who had just had his Twitter account deleted. We could talk a little bit about that later too if we have time, but
including Telesur English apparently just had their Facebook page deleted.
Telesur English had its Facebook page deleted, and the more worrying thing I've just seen, and I do not like Alex Jones, obviously I wouldn't go on that show. Fortunately, I've never been asked to go on. A lot of people I know have. I wouldn't go on in a million years, maybe $1 million for $1 million, but not in a million years. But I've just saw something, I don't know if it's true, that his website is down. So it's one thing to take somebody off Facebook, okay? But they still had their website where people can go to get the material that he's published. If they're going to start attacking websites, and obviously I'm very aware of the dangers of that. Since
we could
lose our Facebook page and Twitter
all
and still carry on. But if we lost the website, it's the end of Consortium News. as it would be any other website that has that's only is a website.
Right.
It's not the it's not a newspaper we publish that has a website. This is our obviously how we publish.
Yeah, it's a right to have any place in the Village Square, not just a prime location or somebody else's soapbox, but to stand in the Village Square and speak at all. That's what you're talking about with the websites.
We know that they're already deranking websites. Consortium News, so that when somebody searches for a topic, our story related to that will come way down on the list now on Google, probably. And there's net neutrality, the issue, where they can start slowing down websites that ostensibly for commercial reasons, but could very easily be political decisions as well, that they want to stifle dissent. It's the oldest story in the history of civilization.
Yeah.
And when a ruling circle feels threatened by the population, they have to do something about it. When their control starts to lessen for one reason or the other, then and people start piping up, they stamp down on it before it gets out of hand. I mean, Consortium News is nothing. It's a little spark somewhere. But as a lot of websites are, but collectively, they're worried. They see what's going on, and I think it's because of what happened in the 2016 election, when they were the right and the left, so-called the bipartisan establishment, was very worried by the insurgencies on left and right with Sanders and Trump. And it happened in Europe, same thing with Le Pen, et cetera, in Italy now.
Brexit.
So they know that their neoliberal project of 30 years is collapsing, and people are getting wise to it. And they're also wise to the neocon military strategies, which show them their disasters almost immediately, where the neoliberal project has taken 30 years to people realize that their middle-class life is being destroyed to increase the power and wealth of 1%.
Right.
So we're worried. We're very concerned about, obviously, anybody who publishes on the internet, and it's a huge problem. But we're still publishing, and we did this piece, which would not please Israelis or anybody who is friendly to Israel and the U.S. and Israeli interests.
Yeah.
So that's another thing that, we stake out a position. And now the Israelis in Israel are stopping more and more people at the border who are critical of Israel, whether for something they've written, they're being questioned.
Yep, you're in a big
Shin Bet.
Yep, that's right. There's a big list of people that are not allowed in because of some of the things they've written or said in interviews and such. It's amazing.
That's right, including some very well-known writers who the names are escaping me right now, but I just saw one today. So anyway, we're not shying away from that. We have a radio interview, the second episode of Conservative News Radio, which right now only appears on our YouTube channel, but we are creating a podcast that will appear on iTunes and Apple and a bunch of other Spotify and all that. But that takes a little bit of doing, because for one thing, it's recommended to have at least 3 shows when you launch a podcast. I don't know if you knew that, Don.
No, I didn't. But, I didn't know that.
So we have 2 now. So we're going to hopefully have a 3rd by the end of this week, and then we will launch our podcast. We also will do video with our interviewees if they have video available.
Right.
And that was not the case with the first 2 interviews with Peter Van Buren and with Joe Meathers. Now, Joe is a really interesting person, and it's a really moving an interesting interview in which I learned a lot of things while I was talking to him.
Yeah.
He was he joined the Navy out of college. He wound up on this ship, the USS Liberty. The USS Liberty was a U.S. naval vessel, and he was paid by the Navy. He was a signalman. He just would signal to other ships from the bridge. But on board were NSA personnel, decryption experts, etc., who were conducting surveillance during the 1967 war between in the Middle East between Arabs and Israel. And Joe there, so he didn't really know what was going on. He knew that there was an NSA operation going on and that it was a surveillance ship, but he had nothing to do with the surveillance. Early in the day of June 8, 1967, he saw Israeli-marked planes doing reconnaissance of this ship, which was not far from Gaza-Egypt border in the Mediterranean, but in international waters. So it was flying an American flag, the Liberty. Those Israeli planes left, and later in the early evening, a bunch of planes came back unmarked and started attacking the Liberty and tried to sink it by aerial bombardment and also from a submarine that started shooting torpedoes.
Whoa.
Now, the U.S. called, obviously, the ship called for assistance from another U.S. naval vessel that wasn't that very far away. And what is now known is that your planes left that ship. I think it must have been an aircraft carrier, obviously, and started flying to help intercept the planes that were attacking the Liberty, and they were called back.
Really?
They were called back by the White House. That's been established. And the United States allowed a U.S. naval vessel and with U.S. sailors on to be attacked by what at that time people on board thought was unmarked planes. But in fact, Joe thought that Egypt was attacking them. He couldn't imagine that Israel would be attacking them.
Right.
But it later came out in a quick investigation on board the ship within a couple of days. But nobody none of the survivors, and 34 U.S. sailors were killed and 173 were injured. Everyone of the survivors was told, Joel reveals in this interview, not to talk about this incident to anyone. And Joe didn't talk to anyone about it until a book was published by one of his shipmates who wrote a book about it in 1979. And that's when he started publicly speaking out about the incident of the Liberty. The commission came to the conclusion, this was the official investigation, which was kept secret until this book was published. It did blame Israel, but said it was a mistaken identity. That's the end of it. Until a 2003 commission by Admiral Mora, was an unofficial commission that he established, a retired admiral, not under the auspices of the U.S. government, determined that this was an intentional attack by Israel. And Joe testified to that commission. Now, he tells me this entire story. And I asked him about why, having been once attacked by Israel and surviving it, he wanted to go on one of these flotilla ships, or boats, rather, it's a fishing boat, that tries to break the blockade of Gaza. And his answer is very interesting, as our readers and listeners could find out when they listen to Joe's interview. He basically shows a lot of courage. He feels very strongly about the Palestinian people. And he told me it's because he grew up in Saudi Arabia, and he met a lot of Palestinian refugees at that time, which was not long after the 1948 Nakba, the catastrophe in which up to 700,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed. Well, some of them were ethnically cleansed, others left for other reasons. But many were kicked out, of course, and their villages were paved over and their parking lots and buildings now, etc. So Joe has been keenly aware of the Palestinian plight, as few Americans are, for his entire life. And he went back on this boat, on this flotilla, and he was arrested on Sunday, August 7th, I guess. No, that would have been August 5th. And he was held for 2 days. And it's interesting what he talks about his short period in custody and the questioning he went under. He was wearing a USS Liberty T-shirt. That's all I'm going to give away now, Don. I want people to listen.
Very good.
To the interview.
Yeah, that's a good tease, though. I mean, you know, this has been a sore point for something like 51 years now, where you have... You have to keep in mind that the airplanes that were used in the attack, the submarine, the munitions, the training, the uniforms worn by the people, all of it came out of U.S. taxpayers' money.
That's right. It's a good point. We paid for the killing of our own sailors.
Yep. So,
and they tried to cover it up.
Covered it up, in the large main, because most people don't know about this.
Well, that is true. Most of our readers do, and we're hoping that this gets a wider audience so more can learn about what happened to the Liberty and what happened to Joe and why he decided to go back into try to break the blockade of Gaza, knowing that he would have been in danger because he had been on one other flotilla before, which I didn't know about, and that was the one where the Mavi Marmara, the Turkish ship, was attacked by Israel, and 11 people were killed, including one Turkish-American citizen.
That's right. They killed an American. Yep.
So he was on the flotilla. He wasn't on that boat, clearly, but he was in the flotilla. He said he was not close enough to see what was going on there, but he learned later what had happened. But he was in, behind that ship, behind the Mavi Marmara, as one part of the flotilla. And yet he still decided to go back again. It's a tremendous story that he tells.
He's a brave man. So, all right, let's talk about Too Big to Fail.
Yeah, Too Big to Fail is a piece we also published yesterday by Patrick Lawrence. And Patrick, who still writes for Salon, but he was a writer for The Nation. And last year, he wrote a big piece in The Nation about a VIPS memo in which the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, started mostly by Ray McGovern, the former CIA agent and analyst rather, and Bill Binney, former technical director of the NSA, one of the most senior NSA executives who created many of the systems still used by the NSA. And they came to a conclusion after getting hold of the metadata from this person called Guccifer 2.0, who's never really been clearly identified. Guccifer 2.0 says that he has said in his public postings on his blogs that he is a Romanian hacker and that he'd hacked the DNC and gave the emails to WikiLeaks. And of Guccifer 2.0 also published some metadata of the hack. In other words, he shows the time that the hack began, the time that it ended, and the size of the file. Based on that, you can clearly and very easily detect the speed of the transfer. If it took 10 minutes to send 10 megabytes of data, then it was 10 megabytes a minute, that kind of thing. And Bill showed by doing a literal experiment, two of them, I think, from New Jersey. Somebody in New Jersey had a server, and someone in the UK, and then they did it from Amsterdam. They hacked, some hacker friends, Bill said, that he had in Europe, hacked this server in New Jersey and tried to suck out this amount of data that was the DNC emails to their computer, and they could not do it because the speed was not fast enough to get it through. Right. So he's concluded that it could not have been a hack by anyone overseas, Russia or anyone else. They even did it from Albania, and they found the further east in Europe they went, the more difficult it became.
Yeah.
It became. So what he concluded based on this metadata that Guccifer 2.0 put out, whoever Guccifer 2.0 is, and the latest indictment from Robert Mueller, the special counsel, says that Guccifer 2.0 is the GRU, the Russian military intelligence. So the American indictment is that these were Russians who did it. Of course, an indictment is only an accusation, has no evidence. It's not evidence in itself, can't be used as evidence, because corporate media has taken this indictment as absolute conviction that right. Russia did it.
Right.
But Bill shows that this could not have been done, and it had to have been downloaded locally from a DNC server onto a thumb drive or a hard external hard drive. And that's how Julian Assange says he received the emails on a thumb drive, and that the Russian government didn't do it.
Right. I mean,
now, there are lots of possibilities there, but that's the working hypothesis of Bill Binney and the VIPs.
Right. So what we're talking, I mean, the question is essentially one that hangs on this data is, is it a hack or is it a leak? And
right.
Binney says it had to be a leak because it couldn't be a hack as described by Guccifer or as demonstrated in the materials that were provided by them. And they aggregate the data and the number of files, how much, you know, the file size, all of that, that stated in the carriage information over the materials presented by Guccifer, and look at the start time and end time, and they calculate the speed, the upload
right.
and transfer and download speeds. And that comes to 49.1 megabytes per second, which is, that's twice or three times as fast as any commercial service available to me, where I live, which is 20,
yeah.
It's around 25 here in New York, in Westchester County. And that if, and he looked around shopping the network and you couldn't find this available. And so consequently, if it can't be done remotely, it had to be done locally, meaning somebody sticks a card or a tape drive or whatever device into the computer, downloads it, and carries it away. And now, really, what we're talking about is a chain of custody question.
Well, that's right. The last part of that chain was WikiLeaks.
Right.
Of course, they have not released the name of the source.
Sources. Right.
But Assange himself, and of course Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, who's a close associate of Assange's, and Kim.com, who also is close to Julian Assange, have all said that they know who the leaker is, and it was not a hack.
Right.
Now, there is one other possibility that has been raised, but I asked Bill about this, and that was that in the Mueller indictment, it claims that the Russians had set up servers in Ohio and Arizona. So I asked Bill, would it have been possible to hack from Russia to not send the emails all the way back to Russia, but to send it to these servers inside the U.S. first?
Right. Right.
And presumably then it could have been then downloaded by someone and then given to Julian, and he would never have known that Russia was behind this. And I believe he's telling the truth when he says Russia didn't do it and that it was not a government.
Right.
But, you know, they would could use cutouts and intermediaries and hide that from WikiLeaks as well. You'd want as few people, obviously, as possible to know about this intelligence operation.
Yeah, all he can tell you is his belief. He can't tell you what happened because he wasn't there at every stage either. But
well, he knows that he got a leak. He got it on a thumb drive and some external...
Right.
He was leaked this information. And as far as he's concerned, it was not a hack.
Right, I understand.
But I asked Bill, is it possible... Were there commercial internet speeds fast enough within the U.S. to do that? And he said no. Well, now they have not done an experiment about that. Maybe something that they ought to do, I don't know, to back it up. But under his understanding at that time of 2016, there weren't still, as you just said, 25 is the highest you can get
where I am.
So you know, you need to go to 49 megabytes. And that was the peak speed.
Right.
The average was 22 or something more,
or
something like that. But they reached a peak speed of 49, which is impossible unless you download it. Now, the evidence of a download, if there was a download, would be on the server itself. But that server, nobody knows where it is. I mean, as you quite know, everybody knows, I think, by now, the DNC did not allow the FBI to examine their server. They hired a private company, CrowdStrike, that's run, was founded by a very anti-Russian think tank guy at the Atlantic Council, the very anti-Russian think tank Atlantic Council. And they examined it, and a day later they said they saw footprints of Russia there, fingerprints, the Cyrillic letters in the name of the first Soviet intelligence chief, which is a ridiculous thing that Russians would have done if they wanted to keep this hidden. They would never have left those kinds of clues. So it's very suspicious that the FBI never got to look at the server, and nobody knows where it is now. But if that server became available, the only evidence of a download would be on the server because it was not done online. It was done only from the computer to a thumb drive or any external device. But there would be a record, Bill told me. So this article is worth reading because there's also new information that I'm not going to divulge right now. I also don't want to spoil everything, but there is some new data and information in the article, and it's worth reading.
Yeah, I'm looking at charts of upload speed of Optimum right now and the average upload speeds, and they're in the neighborhood of 16 to 25. The downloads are much faster. Everybody knows that, and that's more of a consumer. Anything you watch is a download, YouTube or whatever. And so they make a much faster speed available. But the upload, which is what, when you're sending somebody, that's what you're using. The upload for Optimum, even now, this is 2 years later, the upload is 23, 24, 20.8, 8.6, et cetera. I'm going across the last 1,000 uses.
Yeah.
So, all right. So that's that. I don't want to get bogged down in that kind of stuff. But this is at the heart of the public narrative right now. As arcane as some of this stuff is, the question of where did the WikiLeaks material come from essentially goes to the question of, did Russia interfere, quote unquote, in the election? Because that's the only thing, the only accusation that's been made that remotely could have had any impact on the election is that the exposure of the wrongdoing, by the way, not the made-up story, but exposure of the criminal activity of Hillary Clinton and the DNC.
But even if Russia were behind this, they did. They helped.
It was a public service.
They helped democracy in the U.S.
That's right, for sure.
By creating transparency, they didn't attack our institutions and undermine our democracy and all this other rubbish we're hearing in a 9/11 and Pearl Harbor and this absolutely irresponsible rhetoric that we're getting from the mainstream media about this.
Right.
So even if Russia did it, and I've always left the door open that it's possible, but of course I don't think the evidence will ever be made available in the Mueller investigation, their indictment, because it'll never go to court. They'll never arrest these 12 GRU agents, even if somehow they got a hold of them. There's no extradition treaty. And then if it went to court, they would never provide the evidence. They would say it was classified, show it to a judge who has clearance in a back room, invoking the state secrets privilege, and then come out and announce guilty.
Right.
So we would never know the evidence of that particular leak. It's just not going to happen. We're not going to find out about it.
Yep.
Therefore, we have to take everything on faith.
Yeah.
Now, having known this, they could write pretty much whatever they want in an indictment, and there have been instances where prosecutors make things up. because they think it's never going to go to trial.
No.
Tom Drake case is a good example. He pushed them right to the end and forced them to go to trial, and that's when they dropped their case. They only brought it down to a misdemeanor for misusing a government computer when it started out as under the Espionage Act. He was charged under the Espionage Act and could have been 30 or 35 years in jail. And everybody told him to take a plea, but he said no because I did not leak classified information. And the government knew that he did not leak classified information. What they did was go back and put classified stamps on documents that were not classified at the time. Wow. And it was Jim Bamford, by the way, who was working for Tom in that case, who discovered that the so-called classified documents had already been revealed by none other than Michael Hayden, the head at the time of the National Security Agency, in a certain speeches. So they really try to railroad him with phony evidence. So there's a history of this.
Right.
I'm not saying that's what happened here.
Right.
But it's possible. Because they know it's not going to go to court. So they could pretty much say whatever they want and know the media would filter down to the public through this rabid media that we have right now. And so his mission was to get the public consciousness to come around to seeing Russia as being guilty. And that's pretty much what we've got. But if you looked at that Gallup poll for a few weeks ago, American people don't give a damn about Russia. When they were asked to list their biggest concerns, Russia was way at the bottom, was statistically insignificant, under 1%. So, you know, this is an elite matter here, more than the public, who do not really care about all this stuff. Yeah. But we do in the media here, at least in the alternative media, because we're trying to counter these narratives that we are bombarded with in the corporate media just by using what is the bedrock of journalism, which is skepticism. We want to see the evidence. You know, even Bob Perry, who founded Conservative News, of course, that was his position. He even wrote once, I remember, that even if Russia did it, they revealed the truth about Hillary Clinton, and that he didn't really care when it came to documents. Now, if you're taking oral statements from a source and they have an axe to grind, well, you're going to be very suspicious.
Right.
But even if someone has an axe to grind, even if Russia clearly wanted to prefer Trump, and I think they did, and I think Putin even admitted that.
Right.
In his press conference at the summit, that doesn't mean that he did what they're saying he did.
Right.
But they want Trump because Hillary was, you know, threatening Russia.
Right.
She called Putin Hitler. She wanted a no-fly zone in Syria. She wanted all this aggressive U.S. aggression against Russia, where Trump was talking about, although it hasn't delivered pretty much, talking about better relations with Russia.
Right.
But clearly, you know, Russia would want Trump. But nonetheless, these were documents we're talking about here, the Hillary Clinton emails.
Right.
So they have been verified. Nobody has challenged that. Six people in the DNC quit because of these emails. Why? Because they were true.
Right.
So what? Even if Russia was behind it and their motive was to get Hillary, the documents were true. And you, as a journalist, you have to use them. You can't say, well, I'm going to hold on to them because I don't like the source and what their motives were. These are documents.
Right. That's right. I mean, we're talking about RICO level conspiracy, the use of the DNC to favor one candidate over another. And then the relationship between Hillary Clinton, the foundation, the Department of State, American foreign policy, people that made huge contributions like the Saudis to the Clinton Foundation, arms deals, approvals, all kinds of stuff. And these are matters of very, you know, they're of moment in public policy discussions. And honestly, when the materials themselves, the contents, not challenged, they ought to be the focus of attention. And, oh, by the way, find out who did that and make sure, you know, either put them on salary to make sure they can do it on a regular basis, or if you're going to be a prude, make sure that they're not doing something wrong to get this material out to us. But, by the way, thank you. You know?
I wrote a whole book on those emails, Don, called How I Lost Hillary Clinton, with a foreword by Julian Assange, in which I analyzed the DNC and Podesta emails. And they do tell us a lot about Hillary Clinton, and they probably did damage her to some extent, but we'll never know that. And we knew kind of what kind of a corrupt person she was and how close to Wall Street she was, but to get the details. And yes, the Bernie Sanders stuff was probably the biggest revelation, that they fixed the thing. But they did things to try to fix it, and it hurt Sanders in many ways. And we'll never know for sure. Had they not done that, would he have won the nomination? But I think he probably could have beaten Trump, in my opinion, had he gotten the nomination. So thank you, Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton, for Donald Trump.
Yeah, and thank you, WikiLeaks, for telling us who we were dealing with. You know, by the way, I think, and we got like about a minute and a half left, but I think the real thing that drives the media narrative here is that implicit in what actually happened is the exposure of their failure to tell us who Hillary Clinton was for, you know, since the 1992 election.
Well, those emails reveal how closely some campaign reporters following Clinton campaign worked with campaign officials, where they were actually sending their articles to the campaign for approval before they filed it to their editors. This is a fireable offense in the corporate media that I worked in for more than 25 years. There's no way that I would ever send an article for approval to a source before I filed it to the editors. Right. And if they found out, they'd fire you. Know, these reporters were not fired, and it was revealed in these emails.
Yeah, they ended up thriving. These are people who ended up, you know, advancing and then finally, you had, in addition to that, oh, by the way, we're going to be asking questions at the debate tonight. Here they are.
Well, they fired. What was her name?
Donna Brazile.
Yeah. Scene ended when that came out. Yeah, that was like another scalp that came out of those emails.
That's after it became a public scandal. But
right, she tried to help her with the questions. This is unbelievable.
Exactly. Yep, exactly. All right. Well, we really appreciate. You know what? I wanted to do one more thing. As it turns out, I actually do have like another minute and a half. Ray McGovern's piece about Senator Burr, pointing out about Gina Haspel actually seeing torture. Give us a minute and a half.
Yes, everybody probably saw the images of Ray McGovern being dragged out of the confirmation hearing for Gina Haspel to become CIA director, and he was thrown on the ground and injured and handcuffed and manhandled a 78-year-old man for no damn reason at all. And at the time, she was dodging these questions about whether she was involved in the torture in this black site in Thailand, and she evaded it successfully. In fact, she classified the information about that herself. And what Ray's pointing out is that Richard Burr, who's the chairman of that committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, did the confirmation hearings, knew that she'd classified her own evidence against her to prove that she was, in fact, directly involved in the torture that took place. And what happened now, there's been a FOIA, and the FOIA released the documents, which do, in fact, prove that Haspel was involved. But it's too late. She is the director of the CIA.
Yeah, Ray details the facts of the thing that make him say, suffice it to say that this stuff I found was so sad and sickening, I had to stop reading it.
That's right.
We've been speaking with Joe Loria from ConsortiumNews.com. Joe, thanks a lot.
Appreciate it, Don. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sophie & Co. I'm Sophie Shevardnadze. He won Oscars, Golden Globes. His films are cult classics, part of American consciousness. Now, Oliver Stone's latest project was to film an extensive series of interviews with Russia's Vladimir Putin. I caught up with the director himself to talk about the experience.
Hi, Oliver Stone. It's great to have you with us today.
Yeah.
Hope you're having a great trip in Moscow.
Yes, just got here.
So your book companion to your extensive interviews with Putin is being published by Alpina. You called the Putin interviews a four-day audacious climax to my strange life as an American filmmaker. Climax to your career, really, is this the best thing you've ever done?
You know, I have to take the point of view that it could be the last film, too. You never know. Time seems more precious when you get a little bit older. And as a filmmaker, it's a very young profession, you know, and in America especially, it kind of goes fast. You don't get often another chance. So I felt like this was a kind of a climax, not that it's a feature film, but that it's the most, let's say, at this time in history, the most forbidding character to American media, to American, in Western Europe too, I say. A forbidding kind of cross into another world. And I'm glad I got here. I mean, I did Mr. Castro, and I did Mr. Chavez, I did Mr. Arafat, and also Netanyahu, who was a character when he was out of office. He's now in power forever, it seems. But these characters all led me to this moment with Mr. Putin. And frankly, I enjoyed the meeting him. I met him originally on the on one of my trips to Russia, because I was interviewing Snowden a lot. We were doing research with Ed, and a lot of the movie Snowden represents what Ed's point of view was. So getting that information took time, and we came back, and we're trying to be accurate. The last scene of the movie was shot in Moscow. So when I met Mr. Putin, which was in the back room of a theater in Moscow, a play, an old 1960s play he was attending to promote folkloric culture, we met in the back, and I asked him about Mr. Snowden, and he gave me the Russian version, his version of what happened, which was fascinating, different than what we had been told in the public newspapers and so forth. But anyway, telling the story quickly is getting back to the end of the movie of Snowden. We shot in Moscow a weekend with Ed, and then we turned around a few days later and we went to the Kremlin and we shot Mr. Putin over 3 days. And at that time, we didn't know if this would go on. It was simply, you know, take it as it comes, like you're doing, and play it by ear. It was spontaneous. I gave him a list of quick questions, areas that I was going to cover, but it wasn't limited. He didn't.
So it was totally spontaneous.
You didn't have
any limitations.
I felt comfortable all the way through.
What to ask.
And as you can see, every day I looked different. He was always the same. He looked very together. I had jet lag and my hair was blowing in the wind, this, that. I changed appearances several times. But in other words, I'm the opposite of an American anchor. I don't look like Megyn Kelly. I don't look like you even. I changed.
I hope that's a compliment. I know what kind of great effort it takes to get the kind of access to Putin. That's not easy. I mean, a lot of Russian journalists, even top journalists, don't get that kind of access, right? And I know how much effort it took you to make this happen and make it come together. And then the minute this comes out, it was so talked about in Russia. And obviously, the whole American press right away lashed out at you, saying you're so flattering to Putin, that you're a bad interviewer. I just wonder, like, do you care? Does it get under your skin? Because that's a lot of work you did with Putin.
It was a lot of work, but I didn't consider, I never said I was a journalist, and I didn't pretend to be one. I went at this as I'm a movie film director. You know me from the films, and you may know me from some of the past interviews I did with the public figures, but I'm not pretending to be anything else.
I know you said in response that, you know, you didn't have an opinion about anything that you're doing, that you're neutral.
Well, the opinions have changed because
I'm talking about the Putin movie. But then at the same time, I watched the series. You said a lot of flattering things about Putin. Do you feel like you managed to stay objective and neutral?
I don't bullshit. And I think if you see the movies I do, I try to stick to what I feel is the truth. And I don't take, I didn't say one false word to Mr. P at all. I didn't say what I meant it when I said it. When I said to him, I think it was one of the first things I said was, it strikes me that you're a son of Russia. Because you came into the country at a time when it was just in the dumps. It was 1999, 2000. The place was a mess. The real economic story. And what you did was you turned things around. No one can take that away from you. And I think that's one of the reasons he's still popular, is it because he brought a sense of place, destiny, a sense that we are Russian, we have much to be proud of, we have a history. And he reasserted the concept of a sovereign country, which was crucial, because Russia was not a sovereign country from approximately 91 to 2000. It was losing that sovereignty completely. The United States was, and other people were walking all over the place and basically monitoring whatever they wanted. They were all over the nuclear industry. But look, the point is that Putin gave Russia something that is really important in this world, and we can get back to that, because that's the bottom line, is that we need an anchor in the world. We need a resistance to exist to the, call it the dominion of the United States.
I know that you don't want to talk about politics, but this is a very hypothetical question. You have cited people
on whom you've done movies, Castro, Chavez, Putin. I mean, these are strong men. Yep. You obviously have attraction to strong men. Do you feel like this is the future of politics, leaders like that? They're very strong, uncompromising, very controversial in many ways. Or should politics be about dialogue and political correctness?
Well, it is about dialogue, too. And these men all were open to dialogue. You can argue who did, who said what to who, but the point was that Castro tried to negotiate with the United States for a long time, and he was rebuffed. Not only was he rebuffed, he was insulted, and they tried to assassinate him many times. So, you know, what is dialogue? Dialogue is important, and Mr. Chavez certainly had a point of view. If you remember, he shook Obama's hand. He really was hoping that there was going to be a new approach from the United States. Didn't happen. So, it is about dialogue. It's about compromise politics. And above all, if I can give you an overall opinion of Mr. Putin, he's the ultimate negotiator. He will wear you out. He really believes in talking out everything. There are certain points of interest for every country has its national interests. And he constantly harks on this. Russia has its national interests. And he's open to negotiating anything but those national interests. And when you cross the line, he will let you know. As you know, I pushed him. Whatever people say, I pushed him. And certainly I could feel his irritation when I was pushing him hard on the democracy question, on the question of his succession and what's going to happen next year. There were times I riled him more than once. But I am concerned, and the reason I undertook the series was I was very concerned about, going back to my relationship to Russia, what happened to the American-Russian relationship that had existed in 2000.
Do you feel like your film can change American perception on Putin? Because he's being called a thug.
It has to some degree. I'll tell you, more than several million people saw it. And this is on a premium cable channel, Showtime. It is not on a national channel like in Russia. So you have a limited prescription audience. That it was seen, and it's seen again. But it was also shown in Europe in a lot of places, and we had a very good debate in France. I was public television, Channel 3 in France, and Hubert Védrine, the ex-foreign minister of Mr. Mitterrand, defended the movie very well, I thought, several other people against the opposition. So the debate was very French. But in other words, in Europe, in Germany, France, these things matter. Italy, very important. Now, whether things change as a result, it's hard to tell because recently, as you know, the United States Congress, which stuns me, voted almost unanimously for sanctions to be expanded against Russia. This happened recently. So it seems to be almost a reaction to Trump, as Putin says, domestic politics.
Do you feel like Trump is trying to, in some sort of way, emulate leaders like Putin?
Perhaps he is. I'm not sure. I can't tell you what is in Donald Trump's head. I don't think anyone can, and if they tell you that, I don't think he's stupid. I think he's a very sharp guy, and I'm sure he respects things. But he may misunderstand Mr. Putin, too, so I don't know. But he certainly hasn't lived up to the idea that he gave many people during the campaign that he was against any foreign interventions, that he thought the United States had squandered its resources, its assets in wars abroad. So there was this thinking that it would change, but it hasn't changed, not because of his willpower, but because he hasn't been able to get anywhere in his administration. It has been stuck in gridlock from the beginning. Opposition has been severe.
Also because of Russia, no? Because
no,
he was kind of friendly.
That has been the excuse. He's been attacked profoundly for Russia. There's no evidence as yet, as I've seen, that indicates that Russia is in any collusion with Donald Trump. I mean, he's not this Manchurian candidate. I thought that was a surprisingly stupid story, but it got a lot of traction in America, which worries me. It shows you how, frankly, stupid the American voter can be if he believes it. I don't believe most of them do, but I don't know. The polling is off on it. It doesn't make sense.
But if you're saying no one that is elected gets to change the system, does it even
in
matter
America,
who you vote for in America? Yeah.
Well, that's what Mr. Putin says at the end of the interview, if you remember. He says he's been through four presidents, and I asked him what's changed, and he said basically nothing. So he's indicating that there's a bureaucracy. He called it a bureaucracy. In America, they call it a deep state. A bureaucracy that has been resistant to change. Certainly the policies towards Russia have, for the most part in the United States, been highly negative since 1917, since the revolution, when Mr. Wilson, President Wilson, sent American troops to Siberia to join the British Expeditionary Force.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Sophie and Co. Now, the other day, I sat down with legendary filmmaker Oliver Stone in a Moscow bookstore and asked him whether a second Cold War is just a figure of speech or is there more to it?
It's a figure of speech for sure. Cold War, it's a very dangerous war. It's on the, you know, you can even say that the original Cold War, was that really a Cold War? Where there were so many proxy wars that were fought in the name of fighting communism, that you, like Vietnam, among others, Korea, you wonder how many people have died in the name of that Cold War. You know, millions of third world people have been hurt. All over Africa, there was battles. And certainly in the, we've seen now in the Middle East, we've seen enormous amount of damage. The specter of communism doesn't work anymore. The United States was not able to use that. But there is this inherent carryover, in fact, and I'm sure that's in the minds of those congressmen when they vote against for the expansion of Russian sanctions. In their mind, it's some form of the old Russia, and they can't get
that
used to
that. Kind of went away in the 80s and the 90s. How come it came back so strongly? I mean, what is it going to take for that paradigm to disappear from American mind? Generations?
I was quite surprised by that. I was, in fact, shocked. Talking to Mr. Gorbachev was one of the most wonderful moments in my life. It was, I felt that 1989, in my lifetime, was a springtime of hope, a new feeling that this thing was going to change, you know, that the wall came down. All the Eastern European countries expressed a bloodless revolution, really a bloodless revolution. And Russia, too, relatively both. And I was, and Mr. Gorbachev, you know, was not the, in America, we saw him as a lion, as a hero. And in this country, of course, he was seen as a weak man who had lost control of this empire. So it's a whole different view of it. And I've seen Mr. Gorbachev since then. I've been through his criticisms of Mr. Putin. And I have to say, the last time I saw him, he said that Mr. Putin is the guy for now, whatever they say, because America has violated that compact he made in 1989, that NATO would not go east one inch if the Germanies were united. He allowed for that. And that has not happened. NATO has been accelerated under Clinton and Bush and Obama. So, and Mr. Gorbachev has pointed out also the what Mr. Putin says is they agree on the abrogation of the ABM treaty by Mr. Bush in 2001. It was a vast mistake. It undermines the balance of power that exists between the two countries. On top of that, you have the American support, as Putin said, of terrorists in the Caucasus. On top of that, you have opposing points of view on Ukraine, obviously, and Mr. Putin states his case very clearly in this book, what his case is, which Americans don't hear. And on top of that, you have Syria, which, again, it's amazing to me how underreported that war is. RT has covered it.
What about Yemen? Aren't you surprised how underreported Yemen is?
I don't have a laundry list, but
I want to
the
talk
point
more,
is, it's been,
yeah, more about this and the context in which this book came out. It feels in a weird way that when the actual Cold War is in place, it was just clean cut. You know, you had two sides that were against each other. Now, for me, it's so much more scarier because the world is multipolar and there's so much chaos around. And everyone's trying to pull it on themselves. And all these conflicts that you've just mentioned, and many more that we didn't mention, are going on because of that, and we don't understand how they're going to end, or if they're going to end.
It's always messy. You're young. Like, how old? You must be in your 30s.
I'm not that young, but thank you.
Anyway,
I look good.
I guess you, to me, the original Cold War was very confusing and not so clean, us against them. In fact, I went to Vietnam as a young man, believing that we were fighting communism. In other words, there were a lot of disguises. And when you look back at the whole history of that period, as we tried to do an untold history of the United States, I would have to tell you that it's very clear that it was a farce, that the United States really pulled the wool over the world's eyes and declaring and making the Soviet Union the fall guy. After having won World War II, they made them the fall guy for World War II, too, and equated Hitler with Stalin, and all this stuff went on. It comes out of this misunderstanding of what that first Cold War was. America has spent a fortune fighting this war. It's deprived its own people, us, the American people, of better education, better system, more security, health, welfare, all these things that are giving us problems now, this social net that's disappearing, could have come out of that instead of being the money being spent on the Cold War. So we paid a huge price for it, and it never let up. I remember in 89, there was talk of a peace dividend, big talk of it. What happened to the peace dividend? A few weeks after the Berlin Wall fell, Mr. Bush Sr., was going into Iraq, sending 500,000 troops to the Middle East. I pointed out it was a big thing, because when we sent 500,000 troops to Vietnam, it was actually under Lyndon Johnson. That was a huge deal, and the press made a big number out of that. Not since World War II, that we knew those numbers were too big. We were fighting with too many men. It wouldn't work. It was too big. And what happened? We forgot about it. Mr. Reagan helped a lot with his campaign to forget the Vietnam War. And we were sending 500,000 men again abroad to fight in the Middle East. We never got out of the Middle East. I made a movie about it called W, in which Dick Cheney's character, they ask him, what's our exit policy? He says, there is no exit. And the truth is, we haven't. There is no exit to Iraq. We're here. Those 500,000 men, in one form or another, have never left the Middle East. So this is heartbreaking stuff if you have any sense of history. I knew it was a mistake. I thought the Iraq War I was a huge mistake. I thought there was plenty of room to negotiate.
When films like that come out, W, for instance, or The Untold History of the United States, the one that you mentioned, how is it perceived in America? I mean, you pretty much denounce a lot of tropes and facts in American history.
I can't tell you it's easy. But I think it's some of the most important work I've done in my life. I'm very proud of those two films. I paid a price for it because I guess some people would, you know, they don't consider me in the debate, but neither do they consider people like Noam Chomsky. So there is no center in the United States political discourse. It's all center-right. Ever since the Clinton people came into power, the center has become the right. And there's no peace party that exists in my country. I don't see any evidence of it except this third party that is so criticized, the Green Party, among others.
Everyone's making fun of it.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. I mean, you tell me, when I grew up,
I always had this feeling that Democrats were concerned about peace. Now that seems to have been squandered, that feeling is squandered, and I don't sense any sense of consensus. The only one who did was Bernie Sanders, and if you remember correctly, he very rarely mentioned foreign policy. He stayed away from it because he knew that was a third rail for him.
And it was too socialistic for America to actually get somewhere.
Well, I don't know about that, because America may end up being relatively, may have to go more socialistic in order to survive. Because if things fall apart and we continue to have crises after crises, stock market explosions and so forth, and meltdowns, there has to be
they went all the way to Trump to change something.
Yeah, but remember when Mr. Obama sunk, what was it, $750 billion into the economy? I would call that a socialist move. Where the United States is going is it's interesting. I think I'm going to try to stick around and see, because I think that's a great question. It sounds, just to be on the sidelines and see what happens, it could get really ugly and be pretty nasty, too, in terms of casualties. And, of course, the United States scares me in the sense that it might lose its self-control and out of a sense of panic and fear attack. This concept that Russia is responsible for everything is insane, but it's very easy to resort to that kind of early 1950s primitivism like a Joe McCarthy did. And I was told when I was a young boy, the Soviets are in our schools, they're in our colleges, they're creeping into our system. Where the Soviets are going to take us over without even a war. I heard this from serious people. In other words, you have to allow that this mentality exists. And when you're around a vigilante mob that hangs people, it's scary because common sense goes out the window. It's the first thing. And decency and humanity go out the window. So it scares me, that mentality.
So you know a lot about politics. You know a lot of politicians. And you know something about scripts. Give me a scenario of how this should work out.
Oh, man.
A realistic one.
Now you're asking me for a movie. From my point of view, from the American side, it's not going to happen any other way. And that's what's frightening. Because I don't see that Russia can take any initiative at this point, except for surrender with completely all your nuclear arms and have a regime change. Mr. Putin resigns, which is insane. It's not going to happen because the Russian people support him. I don't see any way out right now. Now, third parties do exist. They come into being. There's de Gaulle's that come up, right? Charles de Gaulle, you hope for a French leader or a European leader. I was very disappointed in Merkel throughout this whole process because she knows better. She knows the real story of Ukraine. She doesn't fall for it because her foreign minister was involved. They knew what was going on. It was a coup d'etat in the Ukraine. But in other words, there has to be some kind of European leader that
will say no to America stay neutral.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. Mr. de Gaulle, I was around when Mr. de Gaulle said no to America. That was quite bad.
Really?
I'm half French.
You look young, too.
I didn't realize you'd be
around de Gaulle.
De Gaulle was really a proud man and proud for France. One hopes for that. But there's other ways. The blocks can be broken. There's, of course, China. That's a huge number. But the United States is taking a hard line on China. Doesn't say it. Like it does say it about Russia. But the reason that we're arming Korea to the degree that we are, and Japan, is truly against the Chinese, to encircle the Chinese. But I worry about Korea because we, again, have so many arms we put into Japan and Korea. You know, this thing can blow up in a second. It's like a tinderbox.
Well,
it doesn't look good. At your age, I would like to live out the rest of my life, you know. What do you do? What do you do? You're bringing attention to it. That's the best you can do right now.
To my view, you should make a movie about this. And you should certainly not end your career.
Well, that's what documentaries are for. And that's why I did this. And because I did care. And I want peace to have a chance. And I think every time I talk to Mr. Putin over those 30 hours, I never sensed any other desire in his part but to have a balance of power, respect for each other's sovereignty, and a sense of peace in the world. And that's what people don't accept from him. They can't believe that this man, who they consider a villain, is enamored of peace.
Oliver Stone, thank you very much for this fascinating interview. Thank you. Good luck with everything.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.